Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Roadmap, an old school gaming podcast where we explore how the games of the past brought us the games we love today. I'm your host Grant, and today we're discussing Command & Conquer. Released in 1995, this game codified much of the conventions used in real-time strategy games. The developer, Westwood Studios, helped start the genre back in 1991 with Dune 2, and with Command & Conquer set themselves up alongside Blizzard as one of the two studios to really make a name for themselves in the real-time strategy genre. Just a quick reminder to everybody that everything we discuss in this show, of course, has spoilers involved, so if you're looking to experience the story as its own, maybe step back, play it, come back to the episode when you're done playing. The controls for this game are very straightforward, very classic for a real-time strategy game. You have your keyboard and mouse. Unless you're a hardcore player, most of the work's going to be done with the mouse. You're not going to be using the keyboard too often. Now, the keyboard does allow for some very quick movements between home base, between certain squads and all that. If you're using it for controlling squads, which is the main place most players are going to use their keyboard, when you have a group selected, you can use control plus a number to set a group. If you just hit that number afterwards, you can grab that group, basically tell them where to go, control them around, or if you want to jump to them, if you know they're under attack and you want to jump to them, if you hit alt and then that number, it's going to jump you over to that group as well. It's a little bit different than most real-time strategy games that came after, where just double-hitting the number will jump you to the group that you have selected. As for the mouse, it's very straightforward. You left-click to select the group, left-click to move them, right-click to deselect everybody. The big thing that became a mainstay of all this was the box select. So if you dragged a box around a group, you have that whole group selected. All of a sudden, you don't have to click each individual unit. In terms of gameplay, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail than we did last episode. Obviously, last episode I hit on the broad concepts for the whole genre instead of this individual game. With Command & Conquer, as long as you can build in the mission that you're in, you're going to start off with an MCV, a mobile construction vehicle. That's really where you start your base. You find a little spot that you can park it. The icon will change to a bunch of arrows that move around. You click that, it opens up into a construction yard. You need this before you can build any other building, which of course allows you to build any other unit. This game really established tech tree dependencies, so you cannot build a refinery or a barracks until you have a power plant down. You cannot build soldiers without a barracks. You can't build tanks and whatnot without a vehicle plant. And on top of that, your power levels. The fact that you need a power plant to begin with, that is very important. Your power levels are crucial. Without power, defensive buildings are going to go down and offensive buildings are going to take immensely longer to build units. So if, say it's a 5-second build time on a gunner, without power it's going to turn into like a 12-second time and it puts you behind very much. So of course, in an offensive regard, it's to your benefit to take out power plants before you take down too much of the stuff. If you can take out a power plant from in behind, you don't have to worry about the base defenses all of a sudden. Until you take out more buildings and the power comes back up, those defensive buildings are back online again. After that, you have the squad combat. So each class of units have their own advantages and disadvantages. So you have your infantries where you have gunners, which are good anti-infantry, so they're good at shooting other foot soldiers. Then depending on who you're working with, you have rocketeers or grenadiers. They're very strong against anti-vehicle and anti-building. They're going to do a lot more damage that way. Same thing goes with vehicles. You have your little gunner vehicles that I call them. So your APCs, your Humvees, your Nod buggies. They're very good as anti-infantry. They can come in, mow down a group. Tanks, on the other hand, the more heavier vehicles, they have an anti-infantry tactic where they can squish everybody. And you get a glorious squish sound when that happens. But predominantly, they're very strong against other vehicles. So a tank versus a buggy, it's going to go down pretty quick. The buggy's going to disappear quick unless it runs away. You also have the APC vehicles, which for all they have a gun on top for an anti-infantry ability, their main skill is to take a squad of infantry troops into the fray. So you can grab them, load them up, drag them into the base. By the time the thing blows up, you've gotten your ground forces in there. Say you have a group of engineers. Boom, you can capture a whole stack of buildings. Another important fact to think about is that this game had ground and air units. There was a bit of a nod to sea vehicles, and you'll see it in like the first GDI campaign mission where there's a boat out there, but you don't have any real control over where it can go. But because of the two different types of ground units, and because you have an air option as well, your defense specialties become very important. So you have SAM sites for anti-air, turrets, which are geared towards anti-vehicle, and you have guard towers and obelisks of light, basically giant laser towers, which are geared towards your anti-infantry use. So your base almost needs overlapping types of defense in order to control it and really control choke points. Now, in terms of the actual mechanics of the game, one of the big ones is it has a sidebar for building. So whereas Warcraft games, you need to select the building for what you need to build. This one has a sidebar with everything you have unlocked. And it's basically two columns on the right-hand side of the screen. The left-hand column is for your building, so it basically you will open up your MCV and it'll start off with just a power plant there. Then you'll build a power plant, then you can get a refinery and a barracks going. Refinery allows you to get the vehicle plants going, so on and so forth, as you go up the tiers. The right-hand side is for all the units you've unlocked. So once you have a barracks down, you're going to get your gunners, you're going to get your anti-vehicle infantry, you're probably going to get an engineer in there as well. Then you get the vehicle plant unlocked, you have access to more, so on and so forth. Opens everybody up for you. This game itself only contains one resource, and that is called Tiberium. The basic concept for it is it's a little green crystal, it's extraterrestrial in origin, basically a comet collided with the Earth, and this stuff started spreading like wildfire. The Brotherhood of Nod developed the ability to refine it, which GDI then gets a hold of as well. And what you do is basically, once you build a refinery, you get one harvester. In terms of game strategy, you're probably better off with two harvesters per refinery minimum. But the harvester goes out, gathers Tiberium, brings it back to base, parks up the refinery, and it becomes money. Don't question it too much. It's just an easy way to make it happen. It restricts the amount of resources you have to manage at any given time, as opposed to something like, for example, Age of Empires, where you need wood, food, gold, stone, so on and so forth. And this was basically just designed as an analog to Spice from the Dune series that Westwood had worked on previously. One of the fun bits about Tiberium is that it's actually dangerous to foot soldiers throughout the entire franchise. So if you have guys walking on it, in the original game it's much more devastating to them, but if they walk on it, they will die very quickly in a fiery death, and you will hear them scream accordingly. The other fun thing about this is that the units have stats. So you have some units that are fast to move, they hit quick, but they don't do a ton of damage, but they're good for getting a good squad of them together. You swoop in, you hit, you get out quick. Almost really good to lure the enemy, especially the computer, into a trap with some heavier hitting units. Whereas other side, you have slower moving units like tanks. They'll move slowly, but when they do score a hit, it does a ton of damage. And you actually need a balance of them. In this game, you need to balance between your fast units, your slow units. It's almost a rock, paper, scissors thing where everybody has a benefit over everybody else. Plus, the different sides have a higher focus in each. So you have the Brotherhood of Nod, which is heavier focused on the weaker but faster units, whereas the GDI focuses on the hard-hitting, slower-moving units, so you basically build up a tank wall to move in. There's a limited amount to say about the graphics in this game. They are very pixel-based. They don't age the best. I'm not going to try and pretend. Even with the nostalgia goggles on, they don't age the best. The nice thing with the mapping system in this game is that it is almost tile-based. It's using different brushes, and this allowed them to put out maps quickly, to test maps quickly, and depending on what brush you're using, it has different rules. So grass you can move on no problem, dirt, roads you can move on fine, water, rocks, not so much. It had a bridge so that it would actually funnel people through. This became even more beneficial as modding tools came out and as map tools came out officially as well throughout the series, where the fans, the community, could put together their own maps, design their own maps out. This game did use CGI in it. It did have a limited amount of CGI cutscenes. Very early, very plasticky, almost toy soldier to an extent, very low budget looking nowadays, but at the time it was very cutting edge, very exciting to see that. The big thing in this, I'm putting it under graphics only because it's kind of the main spot to focus on it. This game had full motion video cutscenes. It had live action cutscenes. Before every mission, either you had a CGI scene where it's showing you a map and giving you a breakdown of what the mission's going to be, or you would go to one of your commanding officers and they would sit there, stare right at the camera, talk to you as a person, and give you your mission. Doesn't seem like a big deal now. I know it'll almost seem hokey now, but at the time, this was exciting. This was such a huge deal. I remember sitting there next to a friend at his place when he first fired this up. He got it first. He always got these games first. And we were blown away. We were just excited. And just for the record, we went with Nod first because they had a black scorpion tail on a red background. Of course, that's who we're picking first. Now, for the story of Command & Conquer, and it's not just the story of Command & Conquer, the game released in 95, but Command & Conquer, the franchise as a whole, is really about the war between the Brotherhood of Nod and the Global Defense Initiative and Tiberium on the Earth, and really seeing who gets to control all that. The Global Defense Initiative is seen as a UN-sanctioned group, a multinational military organization, almost like a NATO, whereas the Brotherhood of Nod publicly they're seen almost as a terrorist group, either terrorist or freedom fighters, who are really trying to free the world and take them out from under the, as they describe it, basically tyrannical control of the Global Defense Initiative. The fun thing about this game is it featured two separate campaigns, both of which had their own theaters of war. It wasn't, for the most part, it wasn't you either were the GDI or you were Nod. Most of the missions can basically be seen as parallels to each other without actually contradicting each other until you get into the final rounds of the game, essentially. But for the GDI campaign, you would run missions to gain control over the European theater, try and stop Nod as a whole. In the middle of the game, there was a bit of a PR disaster based on a trap that Nod laid for you on a few missions. And that leads for you to have limited resources, have a bit of a weaker set of units. You don't have access to all the really high-end gear, like the ion cannon and all that. It hinted at it. But it forces you to use higher tactics, and it forces a bit of a challenge. The game also scales gradually. Basically, as you go through each mission, you're going to get a few more units here. You're going to get a few more units here. New building there, new building there. It doesn't throw everything at you without you knowing what's going on. It introduces it a little bit, usually focuses on it as a big mission resource at the time. The main Nod campaign has you working under Seth at first. And he has the best opening line in the game. I've always loved his opening line. It's always stuck with me. He introduces himself, "I'm Seth." Just Seth. From God to Cain to Seth. And to me, that just set the tone for the Nod campaign as a whole. That's, okay, we're dealing with basically religious zealots at this point. That's who I'm a member of. Their missions are in a different area. At one point, for the most part, you're dealing with the African theater. But eventually, Seth gets a little bit jealous of you. He thinks you're getting a little too good at what you're doing. He thinks you're rising up a little too fast. He tries to launch you in an attack against the USA. After he has you in what should have been a suicide mission before, he sends you on a complete suicide mission to take down the Pentagon. Before he can send you on that, though, Cain comes in, actually kills him, pushes him off his chair, sits down, and introduces himself to you. The main focus of their campaign is to stop the ion cannon and to build their temple in South Africa. Now, when the Nod campaign ends, you have control over the GDI ion cannon. You can make them look like absolute villains by blowing up a landmark in the world, one of the big landmarks in the world, and the game lets you choose what to blow up. And this was really cool at the time because it's like, oh, this isn't just the end. I actually get to make a decision in the end. Purely superficial. But really fun nonetheless. With the GDI campaign, the ending of that is actually in Sarajevo, where you're taking down the temple that Nod has built there. And in fact, Nod is in that temple when it comes crashing down around him. In terms of the franchise as a whole, the Tiberium franchise, the GDI ending is the canon ending for the future game. So, as I said, for the most part, you can kind of look at both campaigns as separate theaters with no real impact on one another, except for the very end of the game, at which point you do get a firm canon ending. The other fun thing with the story campaign is there are certain missions where you don't have a base. You either have a group of units that keep getting reinforced periodically as long as you can stay alive, or you have one of the really hard ones, the ones that have always been the bane of my existence throughout the entire series. You have the commando missions where you have this super powerful, he can take down soldiers in a single shot, he can blow up buildings with C4 if he just gets near them in one go. He is very vulnerable to the anti-infantry defenses, though. He can get squashed by a tank, and he can get shot down if he gets overwhelmed. So it's basically finding your way around the map, making sure you don't engage. It's very much trial-and-error type missions in those cases, I find. Not inherently bad, but just not my personal style. I prefer the ones where you can build up, mostly because I am a very defensive player when it comes to those types of games. I tend to turtle up, build a strong defense, get a strong force under me, then branch out. The soundtrack for this game deserves very special mention. The composer, Frank Klepacki, was the only composer for the game. He did a very industrial sound with a bit of a metal influence to it, a little bit of electronic influence to it as well. And it sets the tone for the whole game. The music's there right from the get-go. You load up a mission, it's playing right away. And it just gets the blood pumping, it gets the adrenaline going. It really sets the vibe that you are in a war zone, it is going to be hell. My personal favorite as a kid growing up was Mechanical Man. On Spotify, you're not going to be able to find it. It's under a different name there. I'd have to go back and double-check it. The nice thing is Frank stayed with much of the Command & Conquer franchise over the years. If you're familiar with the other major Command & Conquer franchise, Red Alert, as opposed to the Tiberium series. He also composed Hellmarch, which is... it has become the theme of the Red Alert franchise. I would argue it's become the theme of Command & Conquer as a whole, but his work deserves special respect, and he deserves respect for it. He also did a few voices in the game. He did some of the physical acting as well when needed. I would argue, though, that the voice acting in this game is not as important as the physical acting, only because those cutscenes really did establish a lot of it. And the voice acting, while good, it's the same four lines, depending on the character, over and over and over again. But the full motion video sequences, it was live actors on a blue screen background or a green screen background. It really set the tone every time. You either had the general giving you your instructions as GDI, very serious, very military efficiency, or you had Seth and Kane giving you directions on the nod, in which case it was all about the charm, the charisma going on. And I would argue that the biggest impact, the biggest player that this has had, he's the longest member in the series, it's Joseph D. Kukin, or Joe Kukin. He plays Kane. If you go to the Digital Roadmap website, roadmappodcast.com, there's actually a post up there comparing him from Command & Conquer 1 and Command & Conquer 4, and it looks like he has barely aged a day in 15 years. It actually lends a bit to the myth of Kane, because the myth is that Kane is an ageless, mythical figure, actually claimed to be the biblical Kane. And like I said, with Joe barely aging a day, it really sells it. Some of the other actors of note in here, you had Eric Martin as General Mark Jamison Shepard. He was the GDI contact throughout the game. If you were playing the GDI campaign, he's the guy you're looking at the whole time. He's giving you your missions. He's saying, go get him, Commander, throughout the whole game. Really hits that military efficiency tone. I loved him in that. The other one was Eric Gooch as Seth, who I mentioned earlier about God to Kane to Seth. Thought you were getting too big for your britches. Got a case of lead poisoning in the brain. He was your nod contact for a while, and he really sold that image of, you should be honored to work for us. You should be proud of the fact that you're working for us. And then subtly hinting that he was jealous of you, but almost sarcastic. One other person that deserves some very special note in this, her name is Kia Huntsinger. She, like most of the cast in this game, most of the voice cast in this game, was a member of Westwood Studios staff. She worked in the office more than anything else. I think with the exception of Frank, everybody else was an office worker or a director of some sort, as opposed to just there to film the scenes. Kia did the voice of EVA, or the electronic video agent. When you boot up the installation disk back in the day, this was the first voice you heard. You loaded up the install program, you said, okay, go ahead and install. It loads up the setup menu. Welcome, Commander. And right away, she sets the tone for the whole thing. She nails it all. When you go to Command & Conquer 2 later on, you'll hear Welcome Back, Commander, from her when you go to install the game. Supposed to be a computer, supposed to be an AI, she still just establishes the tone and gives you that familiar feeling when you're playing. Now, there's some interesting little tidbits here and there in the game that I don't really have their own place elsewhere, so I'm going to deal with them here. Tiberium itself was actually based on the substance in the movie The Monolith Monsters, which was just an old B-movie, almost like something you would expect to see on Mystery Science Theater at some point, where basically a meteorite fell to Earth and this substance started spreading over the Earth and had to be stopped through technology. Never knew that growing up, learned that during the course of this, but I think that's just a fun little touch where, hey, that's a great idea, let's throw that in. And it becomes the foundation for an entire four games. A lot of the cast in this, as I said earlier, they were all Westwood staff, so you had, you know, programmers, you had artists, you had people that normally, nowadays, would not be voice cast in the game. Even at the time, Kia Huntsinger, the voice of Eva, she was initially just going to be filler content so they could get it initialized into the game, see how it would actually work, and they decided to keep it, which I thought was great, and I love seeing. I think you might get that from some indie studios, but even they tend to farm out a lot of the voice to professionals nowadays, and while it lends that professional element, it does lose a little bit of that warmth and comfort that you would expect otherwise. Now, this game was big on multiplayer. It did have an online component that you had to go through Club Westwood. I can't even test that now to save my life, because Westwood Studios is unfortunately gone. But what it did have, and what still goes now, you had LAN games, LAN parties. They grew up around this game as much as any of the first-person shooters, where the nice thing is your friend didn't actually need to own this game for the two of you to play multiplayer, because this game came on two discs. Each one contained either the GDI or the Nod campaign. They were actually labeled GDI disc, Nod disc, with according graphics on them. But they also had all the core game files. In fact, when you started the game, you could play the first mission for either side on either disc. But they had the core game files, so you could actually go to a buddy, pass him a copy of the game. The two of you could play a LAN game at that point. The other thing is modem games were big with this as well. They were an option, and I remember fighting so many times to play my friends over the modem, only to have the connection get cut when one of our parents would pick up the phone to try and make a phone call and realize we're online. The manual for this game isn't as huge as I would like. It doesn't do as much as I always sing the praises of manuals for. It does give you a very small in-universe synopsis for each side, so you have a page for Nod, a page for GDI, literally bullet-pointing some stats for you that is helpful to know. There's your lore for the world. You'll learn the rest as you play. Most of the manual, though, it still ends up being a big manual because a lot of it is focused on the tech levels, the stats for the buildings, build times, cost, all that stuff. So that you know, if you take the time to learn that, you know when you go to play, if you're playing competitive, you know exactly what you're going to need to build, how fast it's going to build, how much money it's going to take. You're going to see that a lot in real-time strategy games. You're going to see it a lot in the 4X games as well, the Civilizations, the Masters of Orion, and all that. Because those tech levels, those research levels become very crucial to what you're doing. Now, in terms of influences, this was one of the very early real-time strategy games, so it did influence a lot of other entries going forward. Even the Warcraft games took a little bit from it. That being said, the Command & Conquer franchise as a whole did pull a lot from this one. This set the tone for what would be going forward. Two of the three franchises, the two big ones, all include full motion video cutscenes. They all include those missions where you're running solo at one point without your base as an option. This was the groundwork that they all worked on. And the different series you had the Tiberium franchise, which this is a part of. For the Tiberium franchise, you have Command & Conquer 1, 2, 3, and 4. They were the core games in the series. They take on a more serious tone. They don't play up the hokiness of the live-action cutscenes. They try and play it as straight as they can. There's some very mixed opinions about Command & Conquer 4. It was a different studio than the typical Westwood team. They were gone by that point. For the most part, look at Command & Conquer 1, 2, and 3 if you're looking to play. After that, you had the Red Alert series, which I'm going to have to deal with at some point on its own because that is its own creature that just... It plays the live-action sequences for high camp value. Very over-the-top acting, very big actors. You have Tim Curry at one point, you have Ray Wise, people that just know how to chew scenery and just have fun with it. The history in the Red Alert universe is that there was no World War II. Einstein went back, got rid of Hitler. It's a thing, history changing and all that, time travel. So instead of a World War II between Soviets and Allies versus the Germans, it's now Soviets versus the Western Allies. Parts of Europe get swallowed up into the USSR. The rest of them kind of ally with England and America. And it just goes huge, weird fantasy world. The very first Red Alert game does tie into the Tiberium universe. It's part of their timeline. In fact, when I get around to doing Red Alert in this show, I'm going to do the precursor episode as being the Command & Conquer timelines, because that requires its own show just to discuss. There was one other franchise, it's called Generals. It's, instead of being more fantastical technology, more theoretical science, instead they're based more on modern military technology. It's a little more serious in that sense. All they had was one game and an expansion, that's it. They haven't gone back at all so far. It was somewhat hated, mostly because there was no live-action cutscenes until we got into the expansion pack. But overall, it was a stronger game than a lot of people give it credit for. I think it has a lot to offer on its own. As for recommendations, I don't know if I would recommend this game itself unless you have a real nostalgia value for it. Only because the later games in the franchise had a lot more going for them, had a lot more refinement, had cleaned up a few of the hitches that this game had that you don't notice if you love it, but especially as a modern gamer, you're going to miss a lot of the features that aren't there. Especially the mouse wheel, scrolling through the menu, it's click, 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 instead of just a quick scroll. That being said, I can definitely recommend buying it because what you can buy on Origin, it's only available on Origin because it is owned by EA, but you can get Command & Conquer, the Ultimate Collection, which is all 17 games in the franchise for $20. That's $20 US. And that is Command & Conquer 1, 2, 3, and 4 with all the expansions, Red Alert 1, 2, and 3 with all the expansions, Generals with its expansion, and a lesser-known game, Command & Conquer Renegade, where you're basically playing in a shooter game from the perspective of one of the commandos on the battlefield. Again, a game that deserves its own episode, a little bit different, a little bit weird, but for that value, for plunking down $20 US, you get an entire history of this game series, and I would definitely recommend it for everybody. One of the games you're going to love. And so that's it for Command & Conquer. Thank you for joining us this month. And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that. Please reach out to me on Twitter, at Roadmap Podcast, or come to the website, roadmappodcast.com. Feel free to suggest some older games that we should play, share some of your favorite memories, ask some questions. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, maybe leave a review while you're at it. 5 stars, 1 star, either way, you're giving me some feedback. Next episode, we're going to be looking at the action RPG genre, basically as a lead up to next month's main game, which is Blizzard's original Diablo 1. Looking forward to playing that, looking forward to talking about that. Thanks again for listening.